And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light, 3-0, and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, Bricciaroli here with you. It is Thursday, May 26th. On this episode, we will discuss the league's most surprising division leader as we near the end of May. We'll talk about the bounce back from a disappointing 2021 season that is taking place in San Diego and the NL West looking a lot more competitive than many of us thought. We're going to talk about standings placement relative to revenue sharing, an idea that came in inspired by a story written on the UK side of The Athletic, something done in the Premier League that might be helpful here. We're going to talk about the ghost runner rules and whether or not there's actually a home field advantage with the way extra innings are being played right now. And of course, we'll have a player spotlight a little bit later on in the show. But let's talk about the most surprising division leader in the game right now. At first, I thought we'd have a few options to choose from, but the more I looked at it, it's pretty obviously the Minnesota Twins, isn't it, Britt?
Yeah, I mean, though, honestly, I spent a bunch of time with them there in Baltimore a couple weeks ago, and they seem like a good team. I know they have had some injuries. I know they've had some setbacks, but they're a good team. We talked about this in the winter. I think the bigger surprise is the White Sox not being a good team, right? If you had told me that the Twins were up, but they were only up a game on the White Sox versus, what is it, I think 5.5 going into today. I think the bigger difference is the commanding lead that they have in the AL Central, and they've weathered some significant injuries already. But the Twins are just, they're a very good team. They're a solid team. They're a team that went out and I think made all the necessary upgrades. I think their pitching early on surprised a lot of people. But when you add a player like Carlos Correa, I don't think you can be too surprising. Again, to me, the bigger issue is like, what are the White Sox doing? And should we be panicking about the White Sox season right now? Because there's just a lot of issues coming out of the South side. And I don't think anybody, oh, certainly I didn't, see this kind of performance coming from them at all. I thought they were going to run away with the Central and that the Twins and everybody else was really playing for second place. It shows you how much we have no clue, right? I didn't see the Tigers being this bad. I didn't see the Twins, obviously, being atop. And I didn't see the White Sox struggling like this. So the AL Central is all messed up from my preseason predictions already. And we're not even at Memorial Day.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we shouldn't make them or do what I do and make a ton of them.
Make them all.
hedge against yourself.
But I think one thing that stands out is the starting pitching on this team, because we all thought, you know, Sonny Gray, good. What about the rest of this team? And, I think identifying Joe Ryan in that trade with Nelson Cruz, I think, has been a coup for them. Bailey Ober is a product of their player development. Dylan Bundy and Chris Archer have been good veteran, short-term, you know, stopgap-type signings. But if there was any place that, you know, that I would want to improve this team going forward, I think it is actually the starting rotation, if they could find someone. Because, you know, Josh Winder, their sixth starter, he's been a lot better in shorter stints. I have the stuff metric that looks at, you know, how good a player's physical characteristics of their pitches are. And when he was coming out of the bullpen, he was 5 to 8% better than league average. That could actually help their bullpen, lengthen it, give them another option out of the bullpen. He hasn't been as good as a starter. You've got Bundy and Archer as kind of four-inning guys. I think it'd be better if, you know, if they went and tried to get a starting pitcher, even if it's a guy on a one-year deal, a veteran that's just pitching well this year, maybe one that won't cost that much in terms of prospects.
Yeah, and they have some major league ready young players who don't necessarily have spots to call their own right now, too, which gives them current depth, but also future trade pieces. So I think given how aggressive they've been, it'd be pretty surprising if they didn't go out and make that move, right? This is a team that did a really good job of overhauling its roster without doing a full teardown. I mean, there's been some addition by subtraction in a lot of ways. And I think we talked about Gary Sanchez on Rates and Barrels just being kind of himself without the cloud of being told how terrible his defense is on a regular basis. And also with the league batting average being down, I think his offensive profile is more palatable right now. Like that's just part of the truth too. But there's a lot of things going right now for the Twins, and even a couple of things that have gone wrong. And I think a lot of what is going to shape the next few months for them also is just going to be the health of Byron Buxton. Like, that's been a huge part of it. He's been pretty healthy so far, and keeping him healthy over the next 4+ months will go a long way toward figuring out whether or not they're going to keep this spot and keep this sort of lead over the White Sox.
I agree with you. You know, I think they need another pitcher because this is where Chris Paddock being out for the year with Tommy John, this is where Chris Paddock hurts, right? Because he was that piece that would have pushed everybody back a little bit. So they kind of need to replace him because they're not going to have him for the rest of the year. So I think that is where you go and you look at kind of making an upgrade. Buxton really sets the tone. Like every time that guy is on the field, you guys have seen those crazy numbers, right? Like the Twins record when he's on the field. They're like the runs scored versus runs against them. I mean, they're just absolutely insane. I asked Rocco Baldelli about that and he said, we've been seeing it. He doesn't need any numbers to kind of quantify the fact that when Buxton's on the field, their winning percentage is just through the roof. It's just insane. They're a very pedestrian, I think below 500 team when Buxton is not on the field. So, you can make the case that he may be the most important player in baseball to a team, right? Like that's an interesting debate to have. Like, is he the most important player because of those stats, because of how they perform, because of how integral he is to everything they do offensively and defensively? I think you can definitely make that case.
Yeah, and I'm sympathetic. You know, I'm a consumer of baseball as well. I take my children to the games, and so I'm a little sympathetic to people who say they don't like load management. They don't like, LeBron's not, you know, playing tonight, or oh, Buxton's not playing tonight. He's only playing, you know, two out of every three or whatever. You know, oh crap. Well, we drove an hour just to see Buxton, you know? So I'm a little sympathetic to that, but at the same time, I think it is the way that it's going to work. Like, I think that is the way to keep him because fatigue is what leads to injuries, you know? And so if you say, okay, Buxton, you who play faster and harder than almost anybody in baseball, we're just going to put you out there every day, then he's eventually going to get fatigued in something. And then some little thing will turn into a big thing. And that's just the story of what's happened in his career so far. So if you could just head that off by, you know, sitting him every third day, I think you got to do it. You got to. And then what happens is, when the season's on the line, September, October, when they're in the postseason, then you play him every day. You earn that right to play him every day. You got him to that point. And then you say, hey, this is what happens now. Now we got to win. So I like that part. The other thing that I think is really important for this team is that Royce Lewis has stepped forward and looks like a legitimate big leaguer. And the best thing about it is he can play short. He can play second. Right now, he's playing left and center in the minor leagues. That's why he went back down. I think that what will happen is Royce Lewis will come back up and there'll be a switch between maybe they release Nick Gordon. He's out of options. That's a little bit tough to do, but sometimes a good team has to do that. Or maybe they just option Trevor Larnach back down and go with Royce Lewis most days in left field. And then on the non-Buxton days, you actually have Royce Lewis in center, which is not as much of a drop-off as they've had in the past. So, you know, I think that you could still have a pretty good lineup out there with Lewis in center, Kepler in right. I don't know, a rise in left, something like that, just to keep the line moving. So, you know, they could use some offense, but I see the process stats for Gio Urshela, and I think better days are coming. You can see the strikeout rate, the barrel rate, you know, he's still who he used to be. And if Miranda can get going or Sano comes back healthy, I think that solves a lot of their situations.
Yeah, good depth overall, and I think the the stat that is just wild right now. Byron Buxton, as important as he is hitting .211 with a .293 OBP, slugging .560. That's 44% better than league average. It's a 144 WRC plus. How much longer can I be surprised by this? Like, this is 2 months in the making already. And if you said, guess the WRC plus based on that line, I would have been off by at least 40%. I would have been like, oh, it's probably about league average because of the power.
But at least he's, right. See, at least he has the power. This one kills me. Jurickson Profar is hitting .216, .324 OBP, .386 slugging, and that's 10% better than league average.
Yep, it's right there with the Jorge Polanco line too. .232, .333, good OBP, .364 slug, .109 WRC plus.
Goodness.
Like, how? Like, that's not even close to the level that Polanco was at a year ago and in 2019. I think what Jorge Polanco showed us last season was that the big step forward he took with power 3 years ago, that was legit. I mean, he was doing everything. He was a five-category player with a solid OBP, plenty of pop. And it worked really well, of course, having him at second base last year. They kept him there. I think once they get Polanco going too, that's one more quality bat that they have producing at a higher level than we've seen so far in Minnesota. But you mentioned Profar. You know, I think San Diego is the other kind of fun story here as we get ready to close the book on the second month of the season. We had high hopes for the Padres a year ago, and you know, injuries piled up, and they were one of the bigger disappointments in the league. I want to ask, what do you think is so different about this year? Because when we got the news that Fernando Tatis Jr. was going to miss at least the first 2 months of the season, it felt like an extension of 2021 in San Diego. And in Britt, I mean, Manny Machado's been amazing, but that can't be the complete answer to the how did the Padres reach this point in the season with a record as good as they have.
Well, I think Bob Melvin is a big part of that too. I don't think people realized the, and again, we quantify, and especially you guys deal so much in hard numbers, but there's no way to quantify what a Bob Melvin brings to San Diego with data. There's no way to quantify what a Buck Showalter brings to the Mets. And so I think you're seeing some of that effect in San Diego. When I was there last year, towards the end of the year, it was very clear. Guys didn't really have any faith in Tingler. Things had eroded. He needed to go. And I think when you look at Manny Machado and you look at the years that he's been his best, it's been under Buck Showalter. It's been with a very, you know, similar structure to what he has now with Bob Melvin. And obviously Eric Hosmer getting off to a start that nobody saw coming certainly helps. But Manny Machado right now is probably your NL MVP. And I don't think there's really any debate about that. And he's continued to, we're now right around Memorial Day, just play out of his mind. And I think, you know, having that structure in place, having kind of a guy like Bob Melvin, who, I mean, in 15 years covering the game, I've never, Eno can speak more to this, seeing him out in Oakland, I've never heard a player say a bad word about Bob Melvin. I don't know Bob Melvin super well. I've never heard anybody say anything bad about him. I think the Padres, we made the mistake last year of writing off the Padres like they weren't a talented team. They're always a talented team. They were just playing terribly and they collapsed down the stretch. So the talent, the players, that was all there. And yes, the Tatis injury hurt a little bit, but Manny Machado playing up to the level that he's playing up to and Eric Hosmer having the start that he had more than made up for it. And I think you're seeing a team now that is confident and they're starting to roll. And I think when you have a team that's confident, like that's what you're getting. And again, I'm sure there are tons of numbers that can that point to how this team is winning. But for me, it's sort of the intangibles, stuff that's going on off the field, the outside the lines, that's contributing to what's going on in San Diego. Because I don't think I've ever seen Manny Machado play like this. I have people, you know, who are very close to him who have said they've never seen him this focused on everything, this grounded on everything in his life. And, you know, I think that really speaks to kind of a lot of the things that are going on in San Diego right now. They're following the lead of Manny Machado, who is undisputably the leader of that team.
I think it's been fun to watch Manny grow into being a leader. you know, I think he was a little bit unfair, and you covered him early, so I don't know how fair those things were. But I always thought they were a little bit unfair, dirty player, this or that, or, you know, I thought he played hard, and he was a kid, but, you know, I didn't think he was, you know, that immature. But I think he's shown something in terms of, like, willing to, you know, go head-to-head with Tatis last year and kind of tell him that he wasn't playing the right way. And then this year, just kind of showing what it's like to kind of go to work every day and post up and be a leader of a team. I think he's doing that sort of, that's, I think, is as intangibly as important as Melvin. I think one of Melvin's strengths is, you know, kind of letting people down easily in terms of roles. If they're losing a role, or if they're going to be in a part-time role in the bullpen as he's sorting through, you know, who's going to be seventh inning, eighth inning. Everyone feels like Melvin has their back and he wants the best out of them, and he communicates with them, so they're not surprised. Oh man, I guess I'm not pitching the eighth anymore. It's something that Melvin already talked to you about, and you just got to get your command together, Robert Suarez, and maybe you'll be pitching the ninth for us at some point in a big game. So, you know, he's really good at that, at sort of keeping people engaged, keeping people working, but also letting them know, hey, you're going to step back into a platoon role now, or whatever it is. That's one thing that he really learned, I think, coaching in Oakland, that's probably helping right now, because they're sorting through the bullpen and they're sorting through. And the only thing that sticks out for me as a negative is, so, you know, Manny Machado and Eric Hosmer are hitting .348 with a .418 slugging and with a .534 slugging, right? .418 OBP, .534 slugging. That's 69% better than league average. Do you want me to do the rest of the team? The rest of the team is hitting .206 with a .292 OBP and a .320 slugging. That's 81. That's 19% worse than league average. So I think the job in San Diego right now is to kind of sort through the options and see who's going to be there, who's going to play where when Tatis comes back. Is Ha-Seong Kim, who's kind of stepped forward, shown a little more power than they expected, is he going to be a starter somewhere else? You know, is he gonna take over center from Grisham, who's really struggling? Is Profar going to get pushed more into a backup role and have Kim out and left? So there's some stuff up in the air. There's some roles up in the air. They are lucky to be winning while they're sorting through this. So Tatis coming back will be a big shot in the arm, but there is some sorting to do in basically the second half of the lineup. They need to kind of figure out if Grisham's going to get it going, what they're going to do with Myers, is Voit going to get it going, where is Kim going to play, that sort of stuff.
And there are a handful of similar questions for most teams in this range. I'm talking about teams that are on track for a playoff spot but aren't winning their division right now. I think even the Twins have some questions, as we were alluding to before. And I think the other question with San Diego is, how good will the pitching be over the course of the season? I think they've done really well in run prevention, and defense has been a part of that too. I know Jerks and Profar's defense was under the microscope early in the season because he was getting an outfield assist pretty much every day, making highlight reel throws. But between Joe Musgrove, Mackenzie Gore, Sean Manaea, Yu Darvish, a healthy Mike Clevenger, and now Blake Snell back, I mean, that's a group of six starters, yeah, as good as any in the big leagues.
Dude, and Melvin, I think this is where Melvin is shining, because all those guys want to be full-time starters. You know, Nick Martinez signed to be a full-time starter. Mackenzie Gore,
the seventh guy.
Mackenzie, yeah, Gore was a star prospect, and he finally made it to big leagues, and his stuff plays, and he must be like, come on, give me the role. Blake Snell, he has a Cy Young, doesn't he? So, you know, like, to convince these guys, hey, you're going to piggyback now, and we're going to keep seven starters on this roster, I think that's, like, just knowing who Blake Snell is and Mike Clevenger and sort of putting myself in the shoes of Mackenzie Gore and Nick Martinez, I think that's where Melvin shines. Like, I don't think we've heard anything in the media of, like, hey, I don't like this, but I'm going to do it, you know? I've heard that before from other people who were in piggyback, or, you know, Chris Bassett, even working for Melvin. Chris Bassett was very anti being sent down and losing his starting pitcher role, and said so in the media. You haven't really heard that from this group. So I think there's a togetherness here that can really help. They don't seem like they need a starting pitcher, so at least they're not in that market. But I do think they'll be looking for a bat. I mean, they just signed Robinson Cano, who we wrote his death warrant.
Yeah, that seems to me more like a, hey, come mentor Tatis, because maybe Tatis won't listen to Manny. We saw that altercation last year. Maybe they just want another older Latin player to come in and kind of say, hey, this is how we do things. To me, that was what mostly I think the Cano signing was about. That's how I took it in talking to people, more so than, hey, this guy's still got home runs left in his bat. I don't think a lot of people think that he's got a lot left in his bat.
Yeah, but it'd be tricky keeping him around then if that's the case, because at some point you need production from every spot. But I think that they'll be, if somebody gets non-tendered or released, they'll be working through that. I mean, they should. If they have that roster spot, they shouldn't. I fell in love with Cano, and they should probably just rotate people through there and see if they can catch lightning in a bottle. You know, like Albert Pujols, right? I guess maybe that's the idea with Cano, but Pujols was showing more than Cano was showing.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Here's the Padres position player question for each of you. There are several players below league average in terms of WRC plus right now. You mentioned Machado, Hosmer, Profar, and then Kim are the four that are at or above league average right now. Luke Voit, Jake Cronenworth, Will Myers, and Trent Grisham. Grisham's the worst by far so far this season. Of those four, how many of them are going to get back to at least league average levels of production the rest of the way? Who do you trust in that group to bounce back? Voit's actually not that far below it so far, but it seems like every time I'm looking at anything in Padres Twitter and Luke Voit is playing, Padres Twitter is not happy with Luke Voit, which is a really surprising development early on this season. Who do you think actually turns it around? Jake Cronenworth, definitely part of this group right now too, but he's so stable in terms of his plate skills that I don't worry about Cronenworth the way I might worry about someone like Myers or someone like Grisham, who's so far off base right now.
Yeah, maybe Myers. I will say I think people are upset about Luke Voit because he was sold as this big basher, and he just hasn't been that big basher. I think as it gets warmer, and we've talked about this with the balls, the league is going to come up a little bit naturally, and I think Luke Voit is going to take advantage of that because he is this big brohead. Like bro, musclehead, basher, right? Like we're going to see that from him. I'm not super concerned about that, I don't think. Grisham, as you mentioned, I don't feel as good about that. I think maybe one of these guys, you hope to get back up to league average, and then you get back to Tease, and like, you know, was saying, maybe you add a bat at the deadline. But there's not a whole lot of peripheral things that make me think, oh, Grisham's going to get back up here. He's going to jump back up here. Maybe, you know, feels differently about that, but
I mean, I've always liked, he has like a Vautoian eye, but he's missing the Vautoian power part, you know?
Like, kind of important.
Yeah, like you can't, I even talked to him where he said he gets caught in between and he gets too passive, and unfortunately power lives out in front of the plate. So, I mean, yes, he's good at not swinging. He needs to be a little better at swinging. And I don't know exactly, how to do that. I would maybe tell them, hey, let's get out of your head and like, let's just be aggressive. Like anything, let's just get on your front foot and like, go get some stuff. Anything that looks close to the strike zone, go get it, smack it, you know, and see if like a little bit of aggression couldn't change his, but you know, he's done stuff. He's been good. He was above league average even last year. So I kind of feel like it's still in there. And I like Cronenworth and I like Voit. And I think that Profar has taken enough of a step forward. It's Myers, actually, that I'm not so sure about. Myers, Azokar, Profar, they've been running through guys in the corner outfield that I don't think are that good. So the nice thing is corner outfield is good. Like, you know, one name I was going to say for the Twins was Zach Greinke. If you can get him to agree, the Royals are floundering and Greinke, I think, would be a good addition for the Twins. Is there a corner outfielder that could help? I mean, like a Chad Pinder could at least be a good righty to maybe replace Myers or to help in platooning. But you can think of any other sort of outfielders on bad teams that could be useful in San Diego later.
Cole Calhoun, maybe.
Mm.
Yeah.
I feel like this early, it's always players more like that. It's not necessarily the big pending free agent that you can actually see moving. If you're going to get a deal done now, right? Those players will surface over the next 2 months because teams will
hold on to them longer.
Will fall further away from where they want to be, mm-hmm. and then say, "Okay, yeah, we're 8 below 500, even with the expanded playoffs.
They'll just get Nelson Cruz. Do this."
But he, yeah.
He's really been scuffling himself. So
he's
been
up and down. Yeah. He like had a brief stretch where he turned it around, and then he had some really terrible at bats last week when I was in Miami down there watching them. So it's really iffy on what you're going to get out of Nelson Cruz. Great guy, great clubhouse guy to have around. But I just don't know how much he has left if he's going to provide like a significant boost, you know?
The barrel rate has really fallen off.
Yeah, he's 42, right? 43?
It's just one of those things where you can't even really believe in projections when you get that old. I mean, the numbers say that that projected bounce backs, you can't really believe them starting at 33.
Wow.
He's 41. So you can't just like look at the projections and be like, Nelson Cruz will be fine. Look at these projections. Well, he's 41. Like it could just be gone. The same thing for like Carlos Santana in Kansas City. Like at some point when you're old enough, it's gone.
So we had an email come in from one of our listeners, Steve G, who was curious to know if the way they use standings to connect revenue sharing in the English Premier League, if that might work in Major League Baseball. There was actually a story written by Philip Buckingham on the UK side of The Athletic about how this works. And there's 20 teams in the English Premier League, and each spot in the table has about a £2 million difference. So even just the difference between fifth and sixth has a £2 million difference. If you're first to last, obviously that's like a £40 million difference. And they have other revenue sharing. They have some central revenue that is shared regardless of this, but this is just another way to parse out some value. And of course, there's no playoff structure there. The regular season champion is the league champion in the Premier League. But from just a pure concept standpoint, I think one of the things I see people complaining about a lot on baseball Twitter lately is position players are pitching a lot. And yeah, okay, it's a little fun when Albert Pujols or Yadier Molina does it and the Cardinals are winning by 10 plus runs. That's not a bad team just chewing up innings. That's actually more of like the novelty. This is still kind of fun. But I think we're trying to find ways to keep the game as competitive as possible. And would carrots like this, if they were the right sized carrots, actually work in Major League Baseball?
Maybe. Anytime you tie something to money, it's got a chance of working in Major League Baseball, I think. because we've talked about this forever. Like if you punish losing and punish tanking and you reward winning, in the dollars and cents, ownership groups are going to be more inclined to want to win and less inclined to just want to be efficient and get the, you know, wins per dollar that, you know, some of these smaller market teams advertise, like we're winning in wins per dollar, but you're not winning. You're just, you know, so I think, yeah, anything that prioritizes that certainly has a chance. I don't know how you would get ownership in the league to agree to something like that, because the first thing you would get is these smaller market teams complaining that they're at a disadvantage and it's harder for them to win than it is for, say, the Dodgers. So it's a good thought in theory, but like everything else, it's like, okay, how does this actually become a reality?
Yeah, I'd hate for, you know, a smaller market team like the Royals or, you know, the Tigers or the Reds to get even worse, you know, because they now don't get this pool of cash that was out there for them. But maybe the Reds would have signed another free agent or two, or not traded Jesse Winker if there was a chance that they could get some money, even if they didn't make the postseason. So I think that's the key thing is, you know, does it reward the two or three teams or four teams that didn't make the postseason, but were that still tried? That might be an interesting way to keep everyone trying. Another thing is, could it be a kind of a buffer when it comes to the difference in playoff gate? Because the other thing that should make you want to win is playoff money, you know, like, you know, extra TV money, extra gate money. But what ends up happening, I think, is that, you know, the Yankees make more out of an extra playoff game than the Rays. So maybe this extra pool of cash could help kind of smooth out the difference a little bit and help and sort of give the Rays, you know, more reward for being a winning team.
Right. Even if payroll for the Rays is still really low, if they are successfully building these efficient rosters that win more and are competitive, that I think are much better for the game. I mean, it is much better for the game to see a team compete like the Rays than to have a team. I mean, the best example right now is Oakland, right? They're the easy team to pick on. What Oakland is doing is undoubtedly bad for baseball. It's not just fans of the A's. It's bad to watch the A's play other
teams. And they left $30 million on the table. And like compared to what they've spent in the past, which is already, you know, skint, you know, like they left $30 million on the table. $30 million could have made them, you know, not, I don't know if a 500 team, but close to 500 team, could have put them in the running for this number, whatever it is, you know. We could reward anybody that's above 500, anybody that, you know, the top 14 or something.
Yeah. Food for thought, because it is done in a very prominent league.
I would hate for overseas. Death spirals. You know what I mean? Where it's just like a team, you know, is just bad and they can't get into that top 14. So they can't get that extra cash. And then, you know, they don't have much cash. And you know what I mean? Like, I just.
But that happened. Yeah. Like, I guess if there's a little more incentive financially, maybe then we get a few more ownership changes. Maybe we get teams that are willing to invest more into what they're trying to do, and it forces a little bit of action without doing something extreme, right? You don't want the league to just take teams away from ownership. That's an extreme kind of bad path to go down also. But if you can disincentivize the sitting around and collecting revenue sharing with the competitive product sort of woven in, this seems like a balanced approach that could actually work. And again, we're not talking about taking all the TV money and splitting it this way. We're talking about taking a significant portion of it and chopping it up this way to, you know, redistribute it based on the teams that are actually putting a good product on the field and actually adding value to the game as a whole. But maybe a pipe dream. I like the idea. Thanks for passing it on, Steve G. I'll put the link to the story in the show notes. People can check that out, because it's a really interesting way to think about doing things. We've got a really interesting topic that Eno threw at us this morning, and it's about the Ghost Runner rules, which I just thought, Ghost Runner rules. It's one of the new twists that I don't like, and I'm not rigid. I'm not the kind of person
don't like
who rejects
it. You know
change.
Why? Because you're not at the park
yet. Yeah, exactly.
I'm not stuck there. If a game is running too late, I just go to watch something else. I don't have to drive home. I don't have to deal with all that. So, okay, as two people who actually cover the game at the stadium, you both like the Ghost Runner rules. You're glad that they're carried over and that they're still part of what we do.
I like the pitch clock better, because I think that leads to quicker, more efficient games overall. But I don't hate the Ghost Runner. I'm a fan of anything that avoids like these 6-hour games that just like dilute the product. And then also, as Eno was saying earlier, set guys up that are so fatigued for injury later on in the series.
Yeah, and then, you know, another thing about extra inning baseball that, you know, is sort of a fact, but also opinion, is that it's not good. So this is how it's a fact. Swing rates go up, strikeout rates go up. Basically, you can see in the numbers that most people, and this is traditional extra innings, most people are swinging for the fences.
Yep.
They're trying to win it with one swing, and the pitchers know that. So they're basically, you know, trying to avoid the hardest. I mean, it becomes exaggerated 3-2 outcome thing, where it's strikeout rates go up, But the walk rates go down because the hitters are trying to swing for the fences, and homer rates kind of go up a little bit, but it's not great baseball. And then you have to watch it for an independent amount of time, and there's no stressor on it. There's no like sort of, oh, let's get this done. You know, it's just sort of like, ah, this could go on forever. And I guess, you know, to some people that's great. To other people, I just like the Ghost Runner because it puts some urgency in the game. And most leagues have some sort of extra time policy when it comes to this to kind of put some urgency in the game and finish the game at some point.
So the natural question is, are the rules working as intended? Are they ending games more quickly? And do we have any other, you know, unintended consequences? Because the home team, since the Ghost Runner rules were put into place, the home team is 3 games below 500, which is strange because pre-Ghost Runner rules, the home team had a winning percentage of 530 in extra innings games. That's a pretty big difference. And I think the first question I would have is, have we seen enough? Is there enough data looking at 355 Ghost Runner games now? It seems like a lot. Is that enough to say this is actually not doing what it's supposed to do or changing the game in a way that was unexpected? Or is this just statistical noise?
Well, you know, I think the unpopular answer is that it is just statistical noise because just this year, in fact, the record in extra inning games for the home team is above 500. And so mostly this difference is driven by last year's 110 and 121 record in extra innings for the home team. That's a 476. You might think, wow, that's really low. Well, 2019, the home team was 99 and 109 for a 476. So there's also a 3-year stretch, 2012 to 2014, where the home team was below 500. So, you know, nobody likes random variation. In fact, people would like this story a little bit better, I think, that goes into the psychology of the moment. So I had a dream last night. And in this dream, I was doing some sort of run bike situation, triathlete sort of deal without the swimming. And I was winning easily. And so I decided to brush my teeth. And so I'm brushing my teeth on the bike and I hear last minute, oh, this is going to be close. And I'm like, turn around. And the guy in second just blows by me in the last like 10 feet. And I get second place. And what's funny is that this actually used to happen to me a little bit when I swam competitively. I would get out in front and then sort of lollygag, I guess. And get, I got a lot of silvers when I was a swimmer back in the day. And so I was thinking, like, could there be a psychological aspect to this where, you know, could playing from behind might suck. If you have a Ghost Runner second, then you're playing from behind. But playing from the front also, you could, like, this is why I don't love pipe psychology with sports, right? Because you can make the argument any way you want and then just yell loud enough and you're right, right? So I could just tell you my dream and be like, see, playing from the front sucks. And then, you know, whatever, make my point. Or, you know, playing from behind is what you could look at these numbers and say, oh, this is all about playing from behind. I don't know. When you were competing either as a softball player or in your weightlifting, Britt, did you find a difference, you know, just in your own head in terms of being in front or being behind?
Well, I guess the closest thing I can maybe equate this to is I was a college swimmer. I swam. My event was the mile. So it was a very long event.
Wow.
Yes. And
that's a long
and so
swim.
In high school it was the 200 and the 500. My team and you know, we were a really good high school team. I was a negative splitter, so I liked starting behind, knowing I had some stuff in the tank and I could catch up. I liked starting like I would always get faster as the race went on when everyone else got slower. I kind of knew that about me. But I think when you equate it to baseball, there's a couple things that I've seen that just absolutely crush teams. And I agree with you. I think when you get to the extra innings, like if a team scores one run off the Ghost Runner, you can kind of make the case either way. Like, okay, they scored a run, but they had the Ghost Runner.
We're likely to score a run too. We could just bunt them over, sacrifice fly.
Right. Now, if a team comes in and scores 5, that's a gut punch. It's over, right? You're done. And right. I do feel like a couple things always hurt teams. One is that first inning implosion by the starting pitcher. When the starting pitcher, you know, can't get out of the first inning, gives up a bunch of runs. That team is losing, I want to say, 90% of those games, maybe even more. And the other...
Got to get the research department on that.
Yeah, and the other that I've seen just from, you know, 15 years being on a beat is like the... In the ninth inning, when a team has a win and the closer blows it, and then it goes into extra innings, that team is... Those are always really bad losses.
And I think that's a structural thing there. So what happened there is the home team used their closer.
Yes, right? Yes.
And so if there is anything in this, I think it could be closer usage, because the home team might have used their closer in the bottom of the ninth. And so therefore they're using an inferior pitcher in the 10th.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Most likely. Whereas the visiting team may not have used their closer at all because they were coming from behind or whatever. So
yes.
If there is any signal in this, I would look at closer usage. So if any aspiring saverists out there want to look at closer usage in the era of the Ghost Runner, maybe there's something there. But I tend to look at that 2019 record and that 2021 record and say, they're the same. It just happens.
It seems like it's here to stay. Maybe it's not, but it seems like it is. Can you modify the Ghost Runner rule and say the home team gets the choice of whether or not they want to hit first in the 10th or pitch first in the 10th?
Oh, that'd be hilarious.
I get the sense that many teams would say we'd like to just hit right away, because it sounds, most of the reaction that I have seen,
want to get that first run in,
seems to be knowing what you have on the board.
Right. Knowing how far you have to play. Yeah. Right. That there could be some signal there too. Right. Yeah. Like knowing if I could just bunt over, like if it's a tie game, I know I can just maybe bunt, sacrifice fly. And if I don't get that guy in, we try again, you know?
Yeah. So do you guys think so if they go to the pitch clock and all of a sudden these games are super short, do they still have the Ghost Runner?
Yeah, I think they do, because I think it comes down to pitcher usage. I think if you're going to keep shortening up the roster and putting restrictions on the number of pitchers that a team can have, you don't want them to have to exhaust every arm in the bullpen and have that carryover effect. So I think you'd still keep the rule.
If Theo gets his way and you only have 12 pitchers, I think that they may want to, or maybe you have an extra pitcher that you can only, that unlocks if there's extra innings.
I kind of like that, yeah. These three guys unlock for extra innings.
The other possibility is a Ghost Runner that is like a graded Ghost Runner. So in the 10th inning, you have a guy on first. And in the 11th or 12th, you get the guy on second. And then the 13th or 14th, you get the guy on third.
See, I've wanted the
runner
on first.
In the 16th, you just give him a run.
I think at a certain point, you could just say after 12, it's a tie game.
I have advocated for ties.
They do that in Japan.
I have advocated for ties. I've looked at the numbers of ties. It doesn't affect the division standings. It doesn't really affect anything. And people get so angry when you propose ties. I did a big article on it, I think last year. It really changes nothing and saves a ton of usage, eliminates a lot of overuse injuries, a lot of roster moves. But fans still get very upset about it. Nobody, they're like, nobody wants to go home knowing my team tied.
There has to be a winner. In Japan, it's like an honorable achievement. It's seen as more as everyone wins as opposed to everyone loses. I kid you not. It's like, it's totally cool.
I'm laughing at our reflexive hatred of ties in this country.
As someone who watches games for a living, you know, do you hate ties? Would you hate?
I mean, you like hockey, right? Like hockey has ties.
I played and coached soccer. I was a hockey fan growing up. Ties don't bother me. But American football, the tie, they have regular season ties. It seems like everyone lost in a football game when there's a tie. Different sport.
They also don't play that many games in football. In baseball, it's like, oh, okay, you have five ties. Who cares?
Oh, yeah. I think that's part of it. Yeah, there's 162 games. Oh, who cares if two of them were ties?
If your season has 80 or more games, ties are okay. Yeah.
I like that rule.
Really, it's going to be okay. If your season has fewer than 80 games, figure out a way to break the tie.
Yeah, I could see the 16 game getting mad.
I literally looked at this. I did 2 points for a win, 1 point for a tie, and it did not change any of the past couple of years' teams that got into the playoffs.
That's interesting.
There you go. Should we analyze Eno's dreams every week? Why did you stop to brush your teeth? I think most of us care about good oral hygiene, but... That's extreme, man. Like, do you brush like four times a day or something?
No,
like,
what? I have no weirdnesses about brushing.
And of all the ways to get cocky with a lead in a triathlon, stopping to brush your teeth is one of the worst. Like, if you would have stopped and drank a beer, that would have made sense.
Yes.
Yeah, just, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to walk and drink a beer and like talk to some people, maybe like get on the phone, I'll call DVR and Britt. We'll do a podcast while I finish this triathlon. All of those things would have made sense, but hitting the oral B, like while you're finishing a triathlon, I don't understand.
Yeah, that was a weird dream.
Future Eno dreams to be analyzed, perhaps as separate YouTube segments. I think those would do really well with a little extra graphics and some fun things that we could put with them. But yes, I am not for the Ghost Runner. It's not the worst thing in the world. I will accept it for what it is. And I am not on the side that thinks it's not working because of the results so far. Just an interesting quirk, at least to this point. So when you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now we should get into this week's Player Focus, brought to you by Sunday Leadoff on Peacock. And look, if we have an opportunity to put a spotlight on Joey Votto, we're going to put a spotlight on Joey Votto because Joey Votto is amazing. And the start of his 2022 season has not been amazing. We talked about that he ditched the hockey puck knob bat before missing time on the COVID list. Eno, I'll throw it to you first. Can Joey Votto start to provide power similar to the output that we saw a season ago?
It's weird because all of the numbers that you would look in small samples to determine this sort of stuff, the numbers that stabilize quickly or become meaningful quickly, none of them look good for Joey Votto. And this is a guy who never chases balls. He never swings at balls outside the zone, and he's really close to league average, the worst he's been since 2010 when it comes to chasing balls outside the zone. He has been recently very good at barreling balls. He's lost all of what he did last year and the year before in terms of barreling balls, and he's a guy who doesn't strike out, and he makes contact, and it's the worst strikeout rate of his career and the worst swinging strike rate of his career. These are all numbers that you would look at in a small sample and say, ooh, I'm really worried. The problem is, this dude has a really long track record. You know, like, you're telling me that Joey Votto couldn't just wake up today and decide not to swing at balls again because, you know, he did that for a really long time. And, you know, we have this this hockey puck thing that he used to have on the end of his bat at the beginning of the season that he ditched while he was gone. Perhaps he made a weird equipment decision. Maybe he's maybe that was part of it. Maybe the mushy balls, the balls, the way they've been flying, have not gone hand in glove with his new approach that he's had recently. So whatever it is, I would say the numbers say he can't do it, and I'm a numbers guy, I have faith in Joey Votto, actually.
Wow. Yeah, I have a hard time also betting against a guy like that. I think the track record is there. I think you look at what he did over the last couple of days in Toronto. He had an extra base hit in each one of those games. He had just one extra base hit in the previous 22. Can he get going? Absolutely. Even if the numbers don't suggest that. I think what the numbers can't tell us is, what is this ball going to look like as we get into June and July? Right? Like, what is the effect of the humidor that Eno has researched and reported on so meticulously? What is that going to do for barrel rate and for balls that are dying at the warning track? Are we going to start to see, you know, guys change approaches, or are we just going to start to see the ball flying out a little bit better? So I also am a believer in him. I'm not a believer in pretty much anything else the Reds are doing but Joey Votto. But again, that guy, it feels like every year someone wants to write his obituary, like he's done, the best is behind him, and he continuously proves us wrong. So at some point, you just got to get on the ship and be like, all right, I'm with him, and I'm on the ship.
He taught me a lesson. In 2018, I wrote, I think this is the end. I'm so sorry, Joey Votto. I think this is the end. And I think since then, he's, what has he hit? You know, something like 70 homers. Yeah. 80 homers, and we had a real resurgence last year. And, you know, for what it's worth, it, you know, he did have a big change in approach last year. He, you know, I wrote about how he said he wanted to swing like a caveman. And so we did see him kind of start to chase balls a little bit more and really swing with more authority. His bat speed went up, his maximum exit velocity went up. Like, he definitely was doing something different last year. It wasn't quite the sort of measured Joey Votto's going to hit 300, get on base nearly, you know, near half the time. It wasn't quite the same Joey Votto. But I feel like if this new Joey Votto's not working, he can always go back to the old one and at least, you know, hit like 290 and get on base and hit you 12 more homers or something. You know, like, I think that version of Joey Votto is always in his back pocket.
The O-swing percentage last year was 24.7% for Votto. That was the highest it was since 2011. So full like 10-year break where he was well below that. Usually he's right around 20%, if not a tick below it. So far this season here in 2022, Joey Votto has an O-swing percentage of 29.9%. That is the highest he's had since his rookie season all the way back in 2007, which was only a 24-game stint with the Reds. So I know that changing bats matters. I know everything you guys are saying about Votto and the adjustments he's made and the track record. I believe in all of that, but that extra aggressiveness, if that's what it was early on this season, may have been a notch too far. It's a question of making the adjustment and getting back to some of those old habits in addition to making that change. And maybe Joey Votto is one of those players that we're talking about later on this season as a possible trade candidate. Maybe he's the kind of guy that will get a chance to go play for a World Series somewhere else. It'll be strange to see him in a different uniform if that happens, but I think there are plenty of teams that might look at a guy like that and say, yeah, there's a good clubhouse influence. Yeah, there's a guy that takes very good plate appearances, and there also might be a guy that can at least go back to being a 20 to 25 home run sort of power bat, even if last year's 36 home runs, if that level of power is out of reach.
Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about the Padres, right? I mean, he could lengthen that lineup. If they can find room for him, Voit, and Hosmer.
Yeah, something tells me someone gets moved if they end up being the team that finds a way to get Joey Votto later on this season. This has been this week's Player Focus. Change up your weekend with MLB Sunday Leadoff only on Peacock. Reds-Giants going down Sunday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern. That is going to do it for this episode of The 3-0 Show. You can find Britt on Twitter at Britt_Droli. You can find Eno at Enosaris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. If you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, you should get one. TheAthletic.com/baseball show will get you a subscription for just $1 a month. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Friday.
3-0 Show, you've always got the green light.
Hey,
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.